Good morning. It's the first Monday in June. This is The Conversation from HPR2. A new study says the Antarctic ice sheet has been less stable than the last ice age. The international team to publish the findings included UH Oceanography Professor Axel Timmerman. We'll talk with him this morning. And now that Honolulu's mayor has signed off on the Live, Work, Play IAEA development, what does a longtime resident who saw the process begin to think now? Bill Clark will fill us in.
Science combined with art is also on the agenda this hour. We'll consider a workshop for young architects to blend light play with function. And later we'll consider the art and the work of Richard DiGiacomo and what he sees in reflective aluminum sheets.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook.
Those conversations and a few more right after this news. Welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris.
Morning, Beth Ann.
Well, here we are on a Monday, the first Monday in June, and looking at all the folks we're going to be talking today, perhaps our theme really is ideas that are subject to change.
Indeed, and what it takes to make an idea sink in. You know, how many times do we have to prove climate change?
Well, in some cases, maybe a lot, because some of those ideas may be changing too. Maybe not just in the way that you think. That's going to be our first conversation this morning. You know, for quite a while now, research on the Antarctic ice sheet had suggested it had been relatively stable since the last ice age. Now a new international study published in the journal Nature says that the sheet probably started melting about 5,000 years earlier than originally thought. So, is this now a game changer when it comes to thought about climate change right now? UH Manoa Professor of Oceanography Axel Timmerman is a co-author of this study, and he's in our studio with us this morning. Nice to have you back. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Beth Ann. As always, a pleasure.
Looking at this study, people think, okay, 5,000 years. What does that really mean when we look at sea level rise and how rapidly that can happen? We think with what we've been told as we go into the future. But looking at the past, this seems like it's even more rapid than we thought.
So one of the main results of our study is actually that about 14,600 years ago, one of the major sea level rise events during the last glacial termination can actually be attributed to Antarctica at least by 50%. This sea level rise event, which was naturally induced, had an amplitude of about 4 meters per 100 years. So this is about 12 feet per 100 years, and we think that at least 50% of this can be attributed to an instability of the Antarctic ice sheet. And previously, the Antarctic ice sheet was always considered to be a slow responder to climate change. We have the first evidence really to document that it can respond very abruptly to a very gradual change in the temperatures and CO2 concentrations back then.
So, Axel, what happened after? I mean, here we have all this time that we thought, well, this is kind of boring. It's slow. It's stable. Yes, it's melting, but this is the way it's happening. And then you're able to come along now and to do a study that says, you know, that's all wrong.
So I think you mentioned game changer as a paradigm shift that is happening right now with respect to considering Antarctica as a major contributor to sea level rise. And in fact, I just came back from a conference in Vienna where several of my colleagues presented the first new modeling results that document that Antarctica could melt quickly, disintegrate very rapidly in the next 100 years, leading to sea level rise contributions in the order of 12 feet in 100 years.
12 feet? That's far greater than what we talked about before when we were talking about maybe 4, 6 feet.
Right. So 4 feet is something that the IPCC upper benchmark basically is. We are looking at new instability mechanisms for Antarctica right now, and our study actually gives some clues as to what these instability mechanisms were in the past. And these new instability mechanisms really document that there is more in store in terms of sea level rise. Whether the probabilities for these extreme sea level scenarios, of course, have to be further quantified, and that's basically ongoing research currently worldwide.
So how would you characterize those instability mechanisms?
So one mechanism that we also identified in our study is basically if you have a melting of Antarctica, icebergs floating around and eventually melting, they dump large amounts of fresh water into the Southern Ocean. And that changes the ocean circulation. The ocean circulation eventually changes in such a way that more heat, more warm water is actually brought towards Antarctica. And you have to consider the Antarctic ice sheet basically as bathing in this water. And suddenly you're cranking up the temperature of this water and the Antarctic ice sheet will melt more. So you have a positive feedback. And this melting fresh water flux into the ocean will change the ocean circulation. So we're basically talking about a runaway feedback here. And this runaway feedback was not considered part of the IPCC sea level rise scenarios because it requires the coupling between the ocean and the ice sheet.
Why wasn't that considered?
So because...
But we've been watching the calving of all of these glaciers for such a long time.
Right. There is a natural calving flux. Of course, the Antarctic ice sheet is always shedding off some mass because it's accumulating over a large area. Even to keep it stable, you have to have constant fluxes of icebergs away. The studies of the IPCC that the IPCC included, these were all peer-reviewed publications, they were not having the modeling capabilities to really incorporate these processes. So I think right now we are developing the first generation of coupled ice sheet ocean models that for the first time brings to the attention that there is a huge possibility for future sea level rise, extreme scenarios.
As this is being developed now, do you have any timeline on when you might see that integration complete where we actually have a study that shows us a little bit better than what we've been able to see in past?
I think over the next 3 to 5 years, we will get a better confidence also on these extreme sea level scenario cases. And it is really one of the major international efforts, climate modeling efforts, going on right now. It's the hot subject right now in the climate community.
So bring this home here to all of us, because we've talked for a long time about what would happen if we had sea level rise, what would happen to Waikiki, what about planning for Kaka'ako, other places around Hawaii where there's development around the coast.
So I think any professional planning should include a worst case scenario. And we are considering, of course, we have hurricane insurers, we have tsunami warning centers. We always think about the worst case. And this is something that also urban planners should have in mind. What are these worst case scenarios for sea level rise? And what's the probability and what would be the damage if these scenarios really became true? So basically the product between probability and damage is the risk. So this risk needs to be properly quantified in order to make informed decisions. And there, I think the scientists, also at the UH, sea level experts, world-renowned sea level experts, they could really engage in much more informed discussions with city planners to come up with, let's say, good risk assessments. And that's basically what we want to have.
Well, the way you've sort of positioned that, I would infer that perhaps this hasn't been going on.
Well, maybe it has been going on. I have not been involved in this. But
okay, so nobody's called you and said, let me talk to you about your new research.
That's correct. I know, of course, that one of my colleagues, Chip Fletcher, from SOAS, he has been very active, of course, in informing the public about the effects of sea level rise on coastal erosion and things like this. But there is more. I mean, UH has sea level experts that deal with coastal processes, large-scale processes, but also with Antarctic and ice sheet instabilities. So it's an enormous resource that policymakers and city planners could basically tap into to really figure out what's at stake here.
Which means they're going to be watching some of your newer research as it happens in the next 3 to 5 years, but you'd like to have a conversation hopefully before then.
That would be very nice indeed.
Axel Timmerman, thank you so much for coming back. We'll
Thanks
look
very
forward
much.
To talking to you in future as well. Axel Timmerman is a UH Manoa Professor of Oceanography and the leader of the UH Manoa International Pacific Research Center's Paleoclimate Research Unit. He's the co-author of the Antarctic Ice Sheet Study.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14. Coming up, art and science combine in the creation of designs for living. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, one for you TV trivia fans. This morning, we're thinking about a series shot in Hawaii that was inspired by real-life events. During the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, a Soviet sub reportedly came very close to firing a nuclear missile when it lost communications with Moscow. That story was adapted to become the fictional story of the USS Colorado, a nuclear sub that received an order to fire a missile and gets damaged in combat and ends up stranded on a remote tropical island. That's where the Hawaii setting comes in. The stars of the film were Andre Brower, who played the sub's captain, and Scott Speedman, his second in command. Despite its very contemporary themes, the show ran for only a few episodes in 2012. Today we're looking for its name, and if you know, you can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We'll be back in the next half hour with the right answer.
Aloha, I'm Tulsi Gabbard, your Congresswoman representing the 2nd Congressional District. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Architecture is art and science. It takes both to create living spaces that evoke a sense of place and convey a mood while paying close attention to their geometry and the play of light and shadow. Sean Roth is a Hawaii Island architect who's guiding a workshop for aspiring young architects next week at the Donkey Mill Art Center, and he joins us by phone. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning.
How do you start out with students? How do you define architecture to get them going?
Well, this particular workshop is a little bit of something experimental, and we were approached by the Donkey Mill Art Center to they wanted to try and do something related to architecture. They call it their young architects thing. They're looking for ways to engage slightly older students than they had previously. And they've been doing a lot of work with origami and with sort of tessellization of origami, where they take some basic pieces and start building them into different things. And so it seemed like a sort of a pretty interesting way to take it would be to say, let's look at some of this work that they've been doing with their geometry and origami and say, what happens if you start making that bigger?
Mm-hmm.
And making it almost up to the size you can get into.
Sure, just learning how to create a shape. But in architecture, there's a lot of importance attached to what a shape means, what kind of interior it creates. Yeah.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, and that's a part. This also sort of gives a good avenue to introduce the just really basic concepts of light, how light falls on things, how light bounces around in a space. And we're going to be using daylight, direct sun, as well as sort of diffused interior daylight. And the idea is to be able to have a discussion about some of those basic physics principles and how that relates to basically the spaces that we then inhabit, and how you can use those basic principles then to make something that's sort of more in that world of art and something that's really inspiring.
Sean, when you began your study of architecture, did you come from the science side or the art side?
Probably both, I'd say.
Well, that's lucky for you, because it is both, right?
Yes.
Do you think people who come into it sort of in the art framework, do you think some can be surprised by how much science you need to know?
I think that very often people can sort of get dragged down by, and it's not so much the science as the all the little bits of reality that you have to fit into the thing of, you know, meeting all the various codes, meeting your economic goals on a project. That can sort of end up taking over, and sometimes the art and the inspiration can be lost. On the other hand, then, too, you can have people who take the art and inspiration part and say that's the only thing, and it sort of becomes a very expensive sculpture that may not quite work right.
Well,
the idea is to find just the right balance there.
Yeah, if art is the only thing, the building might not stand up in a high wind, right? You need to consider all that thing.
Yeah.
But also you have, particularly in Hawaii, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but there seems to be a lot of attention in Hawaii architecture about how to use existing wind direction, where the sun falls, how the sun falls. Is that accurate?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, we have just great opportunities here because of our climate is such that we really can live indoor, outdoor. And it's just amazing how if you give yourself some shade and a little bit of breeze, it's very easy to be completely comfortable and not need air conditioning at all.
And yet we've seen an awful lot of office buildings, certainly in Honolulu downtown. There are lots of buildings where you can't even open the window, and they're pumping who knows how much air conditioning through in a given day. Is that sort of an archaic approach now, do you think?
It depends on the building type and the situation that it's in. There's many cases where in order for everything to function and the people to be happy, and that air conditioning is going to be necessary. There's issues of noise and air quality and other things where, you know, sometimes it's necessary. But ideally, you make it as efficient as possible. And then also give people opportunities to change their environment up a little bit. You know, maybe the lab part of the office that has to be air conditioned is always air conditioned, but then you've got this great lounge that's outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Do you see Hawaii architecture evolving to adapt to, you know, changing conditions?
Well, I think that definitely. I mean, some architects would say that. We should have been always doing this, and many always were. But I think now with more consciousness on green design and the environment, that it's becoming really a requirement.
Because given that you're teaching young architects, they are presumably going to bring new generation values when they become architects, right?
Oh, yeah.
And those values would obviously have a great deal to do with sustainability, use of existing materials, that kind of thing, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and so wherever possible, you try and bring those themes in. And so, like, for instance, this Donkey Mill Art Center workshop, we're basically going to build everything with recycled stuff. We've got recycled cardboard, recycled boxes. You know, we're not buying much of anything.
Well, that sends a message right there, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, oh, look what you can do with this stuff.
Well, Sean, in the past, have you gotten a pretty good reaction when you've worked with young people like this? Have you gotten a pretty enthusiastic response from them?
Oh, yeah, it's been great. And we've been doing, also next week, we're going to be doing a workshop at the at Kealakekahi High School with their for their STEM camp.
Uh-huh.
And this will be the third one of those that we've done. And that one focuses a little more on the science part. We set up a wind tunnel and an earthquake shake table, and the students have to build these little model structures and try and survive the extreme elements.
Well, that seems like a pretty good project. Sean,
yeah,
thanks very much
fun.
For talking.
And we also use that as an opportunity to sort of educate the kids about disaster preparedness, and so they can understand that even though most days, you know, we have these beautiful, gentle breezes and the earth is still...
They're not all like that.
We do have potential for disasters here.
Well, we'll keep that in mind. Thanks very much, Sean. Sean Roth is one of the architects who will be conducting Young Architect Sessions, Light and Geometry, Sunday, June 8th at 11 a.m. at the Donkey Mill Art Center in Holualoa. Details are at hpr2.org.
Hey, watch your language.
There are such degrees of specificity in language that some people expect that you cannot please everybody. We are all of us breaking someone's rules.
Good grief about good grammar. People have been predicting the decline and fall of the English language for a long time. Hasn't happened yet. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
More and more station members are choosing sustaining membership as their preferred method of support. Thank you to Bob and Carol Yerth of Honoka'a, Melanie Palmer of Kula, and Marie Hansen of Honolulu for helping HBR to plan for the future. Sustaining membership is an easy installment program of $5 or more per month, and it continues until you tell us to stop. To find out more, contact your membership team at 955-8821. Or you can visit the support page on hpr2.org. A year ago, Honolulu's mayor called his approach to dealing with the city's homeless compassionate disruption. Now Mayor Caldwell is proposing a war on homelessness, which has some interpreting the tougher laws and HPD sweeps as a war on the homeless. But with tourism dollars at stake and much of the attention going to Waikiki, what's a mayor to do? Civil Beat's Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
This is quite a bind to be in because clearly one needs to be compassionate toward people who may be down on their luck and for whatever reason are homeless. On the other hand, when people come here and they see that, they walk away talking about that, and that's not necessarily the best perception to have out there. How is the mayor sort of negotiating that?
Well, he's trying to strike a balance. So on the one hand, you have these sweeps of Waikiki and Kalihi and other neighborhoods, and more of those are planned, by the way, to get the homeless out of sight. But the problem is they don't go away, they just go somewhere else.
Yeah, then what?
So the other way, yeah, the other way to approach this is really to have housing, affordable housing, more shelters for people to go to. So the mayor is trying to strike that balance, but there are a lot of folks saying it's been pretty cruel. Honolulu has already been ranked one of the meanest cities in terms of how we deal with our homeless.
I saw that report that was from a couple of years ago. It's tough to have that attitude toward us, but then looking at, you know, what happened, it's easy to see that that's why perhaps the National Coalition on Homelessness or for the Homeless thought that that's what we were. we've seen other cities try to move homeless people to other places, and it just becomes this endless shifting. The bottom line, as you say, is the housing, and yet there's been a lot of frustration over the Housing First initiative because there hasn't been the money to pay for it. What happens now?
There's that. There's also the fact that Housing First has to go into somebody's neighborhood, and therefore there's NIMBY problems. The mayor is proposing to push forward with Housing First. He is suggesting more money for shelters. But at the same time, there's going to be more of a legal crackdown. He wants to prohibit sitting and lying on sidewalks. He wants to not allow people to, if you will, go to the bathroom outdoors. You know, there's an existing ordinance that applies to downtown Honolulu. He wants to expand this to the entire island. So these kind of things suggest that there's going to be more ticketing, more arrest. And often these people really, as you indicated, really do need all sorts of services, including mental health services.
But the first thing is to get them into a place where they can be stable. And this seems to suggest that there's going to be more instability as people just simply rotate from place to place.
Right, exactly. And there is a core group of homeless that just don't want to go into the shelters, don't want to abide by the rules that are there. And I don't know how we deal with that kind of individual. But when you have a tourism industry that is $14 billion and very concerned about tourists coming to Waikiki and, you know, going on Facebook and saying, oh, my God, you'll never see what I saw outside of my hotel. Well, that's not very good PR for the islands.
It's a really difficult situation in which we find ourselves, and it's going to be interesting to see how that balance continues to be struck as we move through time. Thanks very much. Talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair reports on politics for CivilBeat.com.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Central Pacific Bank, offering the exceptional checking account, which includes an identity theft protection package that alerts users if personal information is compromised. Learn more at centralpacificbank.com.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. Kathy's on the line, and Kathy, I think the perception a lot of people have of diabetes is once you're diagnosed with it, you're going to be dealing with the rest of your life, yeah?
Well, in some degrees you are, but it doesn't necessarily have to mean that you take a lot of medication. We're going to talk today with some experts on what are some of the other lifestyle changes you can make to be able to make sure that you're on as little medicine as you need and yet still keep good control of the condition.
I'm assuming that diet is a big part of that.
It's a big part of it, but a lot of people don't know what they can eat. And they look at our local cuisine, and they look at diet recommendations from other agencies, and it doesn't make sense because they don't talk about how you can eat healthy Japanese food or Thai food or local food. And so we're going to also bring it right on home and have a nutritionist from here in the islands who explains it all in a way that we can all enjoy our local cuisines.
Are some of the Asian diets pretty good for somebody with diabetes?
It depends. Heavy on the rice isn't necessarily what we want, but there's a lot of other flavoring that can be used on vegetables and other sorts of food that can really make a huge difference, and you won't miss the rice and the other things you're not eating.
Well, certainly in the American diet, there's a lot of foods that are pumped with sugar that we don't necessarily know are pumped with sugar, yeah?
Absolutely, and that's part of the trouble. So we're going to talk about what you can do diet-wise, but also some simple exercise concepts as well to really help people to recognize once you're diagnosed with diabetes, it doesn't have to mean that this is going to be something that takes over for the rest of your life.
In the medication realm, Kathy, has much changed in recent years?
Boy, in the last few years, lots have. People will have to listen in because there's a lot of new medication out there.
Well, we'll send them your way. Thanks very much, Kathy.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
Long ago, lines of cars threaded to Aiea's Kamehameha Drive-In. But for a while now, the most action the 14 acres have seen swap meet. Owner Robertson Properties Group envisions a different future, an urban village. The plan was endorsed by the Honolulu City Council and now Honolulu's mayor. Live, Work, Play Aiea is billed as a mixed-use sustainable community with up to 1,500 residential units and 5 towers, offices, restaurants, retail shops, a neighborhood market, and public spaces. Bill Clark is the chairman of the Aiea Neighborhood Board, and he joins us now with a little bit of reflection about this whole process. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
When we first talked about this, as it was first being discussed in earnest, three, 4 years ago, it was a very different plan than what we saw emerge from the City Council with its approval earlier this year, and then certainly with the mayor's stamp of approval last week. What changed specifically?
Specifically, it's still the same plot of land, the old CAM drive-in, and buildings have changed.
They've moved them around a little bit.
And I can go through that. At the beginning, at the intersection of Ka'aunui and Mauna Loa, which is located on the Makai Eva side, they were going to build the high-rise, the 350-feet high-rise, on Mauna Loa Avenue, on Mauna Loa Road. And the community got together, and we talked with them and says, no, not there, because Leliopono was right across the street. It would be like an alley. So we suggested they move it to the far end of the property, in other words, more Makai, which actually decreased about 75 feet. So the 350 feet would be not 350 straight feet. It'd actually be a little bit lower, which answered one of the problems from Leliopono, which was the visual plane. There were two specific problems that were brought up by the community. One was traffic, and the other one were visual planes.
The same that seemed to occur even as we talk about Kaka'ako and other areas that are looking at very high towers and many more people moving in.
That is absolutely right.
But originally they were going to have 1,800 units. That came down to 1,500.
1,500. And
still a lot.
Still a lot. They still have plans, 350-foot units, but they've reduced their plans to have another three 350-foot units down to 250 feet for one and then 150 feet for two more. So, and now we have buildings that are less high. They have less occupancy, ergo less traffic, probably. But there are still people that it's going to destroy their viewplane to somewhat.
That seems to be what everyone is having to cope with. If you're in a situation where there's going to be development around you, there's a good shot that that may happen. It seems, though, from the way this process began, and there was a great deal of conversation with Robertson, that they were actually listening to the community. Is that the feeling that you got as you were on that neighborhood board?
Bethann, it was very interesting. I sat as an uncommitted person to whatever was going on. I'm not necessarily pro-development. But in listening with them, I was hearing the community and hearing the Robertson Properties' responses to them. But I said, okay, I'm going to wait and see what they do to the plan to address the issues that the public was talking about. When I saw the second plan come out, I saw that it was addressing the issues. One of the things was putting a traffic signal by St. Timothy's Church and by Pearl Ridge Elementary, extra lanes on the Eva side on Mauna Loa Road. They were putting a traffic light down by Kentucky Fried Chicken across from the shopping center where there's an intersection. And one of the first things that they did, and this was from a suggestion from community members, we've always had a problem with traffic on Wednesdays, Saturdays, and Sundays at the CAM Highway swap meet. And traffic will get backed up on Ka'aunui Street, both directions on Mauna Loa, and making a left turn into the swap meet area. And I know I talked with John Manavian, who was one of the people, the the principal spokesperson for Robertson. And I asked him, I said, can you do something about the swap meet? Your project is going on. Can you do something about the traffic on swap meet? I said, people are having problems even moving around that intersection. Within a month, things changed, and we had been working on that as a community with the former owners for several years to have that changed, and it was done in a month. That now didn't necessarily change my mind about development, but it said at least they – go ahead.
No, I was saying it certainly signaled that they were willing to listen and to be helpful.
That was the first thing that crossed my mind. Okay, they listened. They're doing something about it. All right, I'll listen some more.
So what happens with all the people who are now occupying that space for the swap meet? Are they going to have to go down to Aloha Stadium or someplace else?
Yeah, someplace else. I don't know exactly where they're going. There's actually the swap meet itself. There's a recycling facility over there, which, by the way, Lilipono residents didn't like that because you can imagine cans rattling into other garbage cans, rattling. That's what they were complaining about on every day except Thursdays and Sundays, I think it was.
But in just looking at this journey that you've been on over the last 4 or 5 years, are you surprised that you now look at this project and think, that's pretty good?
I'm working the project, but I'm judging it against what the people's concerns were. And the concerns of the community were addressed as appropriately as they could and still have the property valuable for whatever Robertson Properties decided to put there.
Now, we're not going to make as if the entire community thinks that this is a wonderful idea. I mean, it's still contentious with some people. It was hotly contested in the council. But the fact that it's at this point now and looks like it's going to be going forward, are there some lessons here that you see for other developments in or on Oahu?
Yes, I do. One of them is, if things are eventually going to turn against what your wishes are, get on board very quickly to see how you can mitigate what the developer wants so you can see your issues being addressed appropriately and properly.
That almost sounds like keep your friends close but keep your enemies closer?
That sounds quite right.
All right. Yes, we're going to leave it there and see how it goes from this point on. Thanks so much for coming in, Bill.
Thank you very much.
Bill Clark is the chairman of the Aiea Neighborhood Board. He's also a 34-year veteran of Honolulu Police Department, and he has been serving on the board of directors for the Honolulu Police Relief Association, a master gardener, and a volunteer driver for Hawaii Meals on Wheels.
Today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you for the name of a failed sci-fi adventure TV series from a few years ago. It was based on some real events from the early 1960s. The TV pilot and subsequent episodes were shot entirely on Oahu, and some of the most striking images were in the underwater sequences shot by veteran cinematographer Don King. The show starred Andre Brower and Scott Speedman, who played senior officers on a nuclear submarine. The plot was a kind of a latter-day version of the hit series Lost. The crew of a damaged nuclear submarine, the USS Colorado, finds refuge on a remote tropical island and struggles to get back in contact. For them, life on the island is the last resort, and that's the name of the show. It's 8:46, and that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, good morning. I'm James McDowell from Grand Illusion. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Find out more about the show at hpr2.org.
It's time for Stargazer. Aloha, I'm Dave Lawrence, and it's time for our weekly look at what's happening in the world of astronomy, what's going on in our island skies. We turn to Christopher Phillips, Emilo Astronomy Center, our official connection to the Mauna Kea Summit Research Community. Hey, Christopher, aloha. What's going on this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be back. Firstly, Mars high in the south, Hema, and Saturn will be visible in the west, Komohana, around about 8 p.m., with Venus rising around about 4 a.m. Now, the moon is moving past its crescent phase this week, and so this means dark island skies, perfect for spotting meteors and satellites.
I know last week we had the ISS. Anything like that this week?
Yeah, so this week we have a space station bonanza. On Tuesday, June the 3rd, the Chinese Tiangong 1 will be passing from the northwest to the northeast at around about 7:46 p.m. And then on Wednesday, June the 4th, the ISS will be making a pass from the west-southwest to the north-northeast.
And we have an update this week on some testimony that occurred that relates to the search for life in space.
That's right, Dave. Bold claims from D.C. last week. Two scientists from the SETI Institute, that's the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, spoke during a hearing of the U.S. House Science and Technology Committee. Doctors Seth Shostak and Dan Wertheimer told a hearing that solid evidence for the existence of life in our galaxy will be found within the next two decades. This may seem like a bold claim, but we have known for years that the universe is full of all the ingredients needed for life as we know it. There is a variety of ways that evidence for life could be found. Firstly, we could find life by using robotic probes and landers. We'll most likely find this life in the deep oceans of Europa and some other moons. Secondly, we could study the atmospheres of distant worlds using ground and space-based telescopes. We could tell if these worlds perhaps show chemical markers of life in their alien skies by using something called spectroscopy, the method of detecting chemicals by the light they emit or absorb.
Mm.
And then finally, we may be able to intercept communications or signals from intelligent species using giant radio telescopes. This three-pronged attack will force the issue, and the answer to the question of are we alone in the universe will be revealed sooner rather than later.
That sounds fascinating, Christopher, and I appreciate the heads up. We're really looking forward to getting more information.
You are welcome, Dave.
Christopher Phillips, Emilo Astronomy Center on Hawaii Island, and I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next time here for Stargazer.
Richard DiGiacomo's art is defined, at least in part, by his choice of materials. He works in metals, shaping aluminum panels, mixing in various colors, and using the shimmer of their reflective surfaces to create a texture that can look like the surface of the ocean, constantly changing in the light. His work is on display in Paia, Maui, and he's on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Pretty good. What was the attraction of working with the aluminum panels you're working with now?
My attraction?
Yeah.
Well, you can get into past 3D with it, and it's just amazing. I dream about it. My mind's like a kaleidoscope. The more you grind on it, the more illusion you can create in different levels, kind of like a hologram effect. 3D to where I do a lot of waves and ocean waves and the barrels, and the foam looks like it's actually moving and has a hologram effect and various colors that are fused in there. A lot of people think they're glass.
I was reminded of the qualities of the ocean surface itself in what you've done with the aluminum.
Not understanding you there.
The same, well, it seems to have the same kind of iridescence that the surface of the ocean.
Exactly. Yeah, and aluminum, when you get it, when I get the sheets, they're shiny. And when you sand aluminum, if you were to put it under a microscope, every color of the rainbow, it's prism in aluminum. So there's red, yellows, blues. So that has a lot of effect, especially if I do a monochromatic, and it's on the wall, and a sunset from Maui would hit it. It just lights it up and brings all the colors out. It's like just fabulous.
I would think that one of the attractions, Richard, would be that your finished product isn't fixed. It changes with the light surface on it, yeah?
Exactly. It's always changing, and that's the beauty of it, where it's phenomenally always changing, so it's not just like a regular piece of art.
How do you get the color in it, Richard?
I use an airbrush and with candy apple paint, with automotive paints. I just started hand painting a few. I just only have a few out there that are hand painted. And I use acrylics for that, water-based. Takes more time. And then just getting into acid etching with colored acids to burn the metal and fuse different colors in there with various colors of acid.
How does that work? How do you apply the acid to the surface?
Very carefully with an eyedropper and a brush, and then you can use dry ice to manipulate it.
What does the dry ice do, Richard?
It'll fog it up and make it crystally looking. It even has more effect.
It sounds as if you're still discovering new techniques even after doing this for a lot of years, are you?
All the time. It's quantum leaps every week with this. It's just a phenomenal product.
Was there much precedent for this, the work that you're doing? Were there other artists whose work kind of inspired you with their use of this particular material?
Yeah, there's a few, especially Andreas Nadibaum up in Mockwell. He's the king. I mean, he's great. Haven't figured him out yet, but and a lot of other guys in Lahaina. But pretty much, once you get into this, you just take off into a different venue. You just start creating, and just all kind of thing happens. And most of it I found by accident, especially this 3D look in the foam, which nobody else has, which I found by accident, of course.
Has your career as an artist had a lot of these happy accidents in it?
Oh, sure. That's how it all happens.
But you also have that kind of thing of not knowing entirely what your finished product is going to look like, right?
Right. Generally, you do. But if you get into playing around, you create something and you don't remember how you did it because there's so many levels of it. It's almost like you get into physics with it.
Well, that's that. We talked a little bit earlier in the show about the kind of a fusion of art and science in architecture. But in fine art, there's a lot of that too. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, given that, Richard, and sort of your ongoing fascination with these materials, is metal where you're going in your future as an artist?
Yeah, I see that, you know, metal could be temporary, abstract temporary, but I really don't see that, especially on Maui. I'm keeping my prices are very affordable. The tourists love them. The local surfers love them. So I know I got something that's, that really is it's a good seller, and I think it'll last because a lot of contemporary stuff does, and it's fatty and it's trendy, but I think this will really last.
Part of it, for you as an artist, you have to be sort of accepting of a little bit of a surprise in how that finished product come out, yeah?
It depends how far, once you find a certain standard, I stick with it. I try to keep it simple, but then there's so many alternatives and so many variables that you can add to it without getting way out there, so you know what you're going to get. Unless I do one that I play around with and it's just a one of a kind and you don't know how you did it when you're done. And those are extreme. Those are good ones, but those are once in a while.
Well, it sounds very rewarding, Richard, and thanks very much for talking with us this morning.
Okay, thank you for having me.
You bet.
Okay, have a great day.
You too. Richard DiGiacomo is an artist who works in metal, and his work is on display at the Maui Hands Gallery. You can learn more about him at hpr2.org.
Tickets are on sale now to station members for Jeff Peterson and Friends Hana Ho, an afternoon of Hawaiian music with Slack Key artist Jeff Peterson, along with Raiatea Helm and Nathan Aveau. Enjoy the music of this award-winning trio on Sunday, August 3rd at the Palikū Theater in Windward, Oahu. Advance sales to HPR members through June 14th at 955-8821 or online at hbrtickets.org.
You just talked to Richard DiGiacomo on the island of Maui. We have some exciting news around here. We're going to take the conversation to Kauai for the very first time ever since this show started, and we'll be there later on this week on Wednesday and Thursday.
Terrific. We'll be talking to you via remote in the studio here.
A two-island broadcast, as we always do. I get on the plane and go elsewhere, and you get to hold things down here.
That's right.
We see how we can make all of that match as we go island to island, but a lot of good fun to get out and really excited to be coming to Kauai. We'll be up at KKCR on the Wednesday and down at KCC on Thursday and enjoying the time there and really looking forward to being on Kauai.
Well, we certainly talk to a lot of people from Kauai on the show, and it'll be good to get a little closer to the source.
Well, there's something different when you actually get the slippers on the ground, you know. It's a little bit different than when we talk over the phone is usually what we have to do. But at least we have that part of it.
Exactly.
So that's going to do it for us for today. Up tomorrow, we're going to pick up the conversation about homelessness with the National Director of Quality Improvement for the 100,000 Homes Campaign. Remember, we talked about that last week. Beth Sander will be here with us.
And how children's literature deals with war and how it has changed down through the years.
In the meantime, there are lots of ways for you to be in touch. You can write to us on Facebook. Our page is Hawaii Conversation. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And we're on Twitter, too, at HI Conversation. And you can get to me at BKOZHPR.
Hear today's show again. Get another past show. Our links to more information about topics and guests on the Conversation Archive. It's on the HPR2 website, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll be back with you tomorrow morning for a Tuesday look at the conversation. Have a good day.